This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Mysterious Skin, tells the parallel stories of 2 8-year-old boys who are sexually molested by their Little League coach and affected in completely different ways. One later becomes a gay prostitute. The other is so traumatized, he blanks out the memories and is haunted by his inability to account for the missing time. All he knows is that something terrible happened. He later comes to believe that the only explanation is that he was abducted by aliens. The movie traces the lives of these two boys into their late teens. My guests are Greg Araki, the director, screenwriter, and producer of the film, and Scott Heim, author of the novel Mysterious Skin, which the movie's based on. The New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote, "The film's subject matter may be grim. Mr. Araki addresses the characters' sexual experiences with unflinching candor. But Mysterious Skin is infused with remarkable tenderness and beauty. It's one of the best movies I've seen so far this year." The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Cunningham said about novelist Scott Heim, "He's a serious writer who's unafraid to swim in the darkest waters." Scott Heim, Greg Araki, welcome to Fresh Air. Scott Heim, let me start with you. You wrote the novel that the new film Mysterious Skin is based on. Why did you want to compare how two boys were affected by being sexually abused by their Little League coach?
Well, I think the initial sort of genesis of the book came about because I had written a short story that was about a kid who had been sexually abused in his past. And then I started writing a short story, you know, just completely separately about a boy who thinks he has, you know, memories of a UFO abduction. And, you know, they were quite a different time period away from each other. But I realized at some point just how similar people's memories are, or, you know, when people go under hypnosis for supposed alien abduction, the things they say are just really similar to the things people say when they, you know, have sort of recovered memory of child abuse or molestation.
What are some of those similarities between abduction stories and recovered memories?
Well, I think, you know, initially what I was struck by was just sort of some of the, you know, sort of the tactile things that people were reporting, and, you know, things like the way it felt to be examined on a table or touched by these sort of extraterrestrial hands, and, you know, how people feel violated when, you know, they think they've, you know, been examined by aliens. And, you know, sometimes when people read the book, or sometimes when I've explained the book to people, people kind of nervously laugh, or, you know, it's usually the skeptical people that think, you know, that's just silly. Why would people actually believe that happened to them? But, you know, I hope that in writing the book, and I think Greg would maybe say the same thing in making the movie, I didn't want to discount those people's stories, because, you know, I don't know if those stories are real or imagined or fake. I just know that a lot of people have those, you know, memories or have those experiences that they, you know, they think they honestly had. And it's just fascinating to me how similar they are to the people who, you know, bury their memories of being molested. And, you know, when they come out in hypnosis, the things they say are very, very similar.
Greg Araki, why did you want to make a film based on Scott Heim's novel Mysterious Skin? What did you relate to about the story?
I first read the book back in 1995 when it was first published. And it really just floored me. I mean, I've never read such a powerful story. It had a huge kind of emotional impact on me. And I was really struck by how Scott managed to tell this very dark, very unsettling story, but in this incredibly beautiful and poetic language. And we really tried to translate that to the screen in our adaptation. I mean, Scott, I think, is an, you know, extraordinarily talented writer, and the way he uses language was it was so lyrical and so beautiful, and we really wanted to sort of replicate that with the cinematography and the design of the movie.
Well, I'd like to compare how you each handled a pivotal scene from early in the story, and this is a scene in which the coach, the Little League coach, seduces Neil. And it shows the shift in tone that the coach uses. You know, first, you know, the coach alternates between being very seductive and clowning around as if he were another child. Neil has gone back to the coach's house. The coach's house is filled with video games and toys and the kinds of foods that kids love. In fact, the food that figures into this particular scene is a variety pack of cereals, you know, the kind of pack that has lots of small boxes of different cereals in it. And I want to play a clip from the film. And it starts with the coach in his apartment, sitting next to Neil, and the coach is putting his hand on Neil's leg.
Neil, I've been thinking a lot about you this week.
I'm hungry.
Sure. You want a pizza? I might have something here you'd like.
Whoa.
What'll it be, little buddy?
My mom never buys these things. She says they're a big waste of money.
Let's eat then.
A scene from Mysterious Skin, and at this point in the scene, the coach chooses his favorite sugared cereal, and Neil, the boy, chooses his favorite sugared cereal, and as they start to eat, Neil accidentally spills some cereal, and he feels bad, and the coach says, don't worry about it, and the coach starts just taking his cereal and throwing it up in the air, and then they both start opening up cereal boxes and tossing the cereal up in the air, and after this moment of childish abandon, the coach starts molesting the boy. Scott Heim, the movie Mysterious Skin is based on your novel of the same name. Can you talk a little bit about writing this scene and why you set this first molestation in this environment of childhood exuberance and of kid cereal, you know, of the kind of sugared cereals that children eat, and the cereal is now all over the floor?
The whole book for me, writing the whole book in a lot of ways is about juxtaposing extremes. For instance, I wanted to have this really dark material set in Kansas, where I'm from, because people usually think of Kansas as this sort of serene, safe place. And so for me, that scene, literally the first molestation or first, you know, sexual encounter between the boy and the man in the movie, you know, takes place on top of the spilled cereal and on the kitchen floor. So I wanted to have kind of this really bright, colorful image of childhood, which, you know, sort of the brightest kind of child cereal that you can think of, and sort of use that as the bed for where this initial, you know, sort of horrifying, life-changing sexual experience takes place. And, you know, for me, that was kind of the scene that, it was one of the first scenes in the book that I wrote, and I was actually writing the book when I was getting my MFA degree at Columbia, and that was kind of the scene that a lot of my classmates bristled at, and a lot of people said, you know, I think you're going too far with this, and people are really going to be angry. And my teacher pulled me aside and said, listen, this is kind of going to be the thing that drives your book, and you know, sure, it will make people angry, but it's kind of one of the major, you know, turning points of your book. So she, you know, suggested that I sort of go further with it, and I did.
Greg Araki, can you talk about directing the scene in the film, what you wanted to show or imply? And I want to say that the coach in this scene is really behaving like a kid, and he's even, like, when he's throwing the cereal up in the air, he's sticking his tongue out in the kind of way that some children do when they're concentrating on trying to read or draw, and he's so behaving like a child, but then he turns around and becomes this, you know, sexual molester.
Bill Sage, the actor who plays the coach, I think did an amazing job with his character. I mean, obviously it's extremely challenging role for an actor. And he really sort of keyed into that idea that the coach was sort of, in a way, this sort of overgrown boy, and had turned his house sort of into this boys' club. I mean, the scene, you know, as we're talking about it, I mean, is probably one of the most disturbing scenes in the whole book. But it was really so important to me as a filmmaker to not take this scene out of the film adaptation, because it was one of the scenes that really sort of blew me away when I read it. I mean, it is disturbing, but there's such a sort of rawness and such a sort of truth to it, and it's really I think one of the most powerful scenes in the book and in the film. The tricky part was that I didn't want to traumatize the young boy who's playing young Neil, 8-year-old Chase Allison. And it was very important to the producer, Mary Jane, and I to not traumatize any children in the making of this film about childhood trauma. So what we ended up doing was, the film is that scene is extremely cleverly shot in a way, in the sense that It's really all in the sort of editing and in that use of subjective camera and eye line, like where the actors are actually looking. And we had to film the scene. I wanted to like keep the scene for all its sort of, you know, the importance it had to the story, but I wanted to also film it in a way where the young boy could be protected from what the scene was actually about. And this was basically true of the whole film. Both Chase and George were George Webster plays young Brian. They were kept from what the actual. They had never read the entire script and sort of only did their scenes beat by beat and kind of moment by moment. And we had to sort of construct this almost alternate reality or an alternate movie that the kids were actually performing in.
But you know, in this scene, what happens between the coach and the boy is implied. We don't see it.
Yeah, and it's actually filmed in. For people who are very astute sort of film students or filmmakers, they can see how the scene is shot in two halves. So the halves are brought together through editing, so it feels like this extremely horrifying thing is actually happening when it really is kind of. It never happened in reality, but it's happening on the screen.
Now Neil, the boy in this scene, he basically knows as a child that he's attracted to other men. And before the coach molests him, first time he sees the coach, he's thinking, wow, this guy reminds me of the kind of guys that, you know, that he loves to look at in magazines, that kind of Marlboro man type with the mustache, the macho kind of looking guy. In the actual novel, the character thinks, remembering back to this moment, desire sledgehammered my body. Does that make the coach's actions any less reprehensible to either of you? The fact that the boy is actually attracted to the coach.
Yeah, that was one of the things about the book that, you know, as I said before, was really what makes the book for me such a powerful kind of experience, or makes the story such a powerful experience, is the way that Scott has sort of constructed it in the way that there are these two boys. There's, you know, Brian, who is, you know, fair-haired and blonde and, you know, is very introverted and believes that he was abducted by an alien. He sort of blocks this trauma out of his memory. And then there's Neil, who's dark-haired and who is from a very young age gay and has this, you know, gay desire for the coach. The fact that there are both of these stories and these boys in a way sort of function as yin and yang and dark and light to each other, both their stories combined and the way in which they each experience this trauma and then deal with it in polar opposite ways, the sort of aftermath of what happens to them, I think that's, for me, what really makes the story work.
You know, the character of Neil as a teenager looking back on this experience of being sexually molested by the coach thinks, half of me realized it wasn't right, the other half wanted it to happen. And he also thinks, oftentimes I wonder where Coach lives now, what he's doing, whether something like prison or lynch mobs or disease hasn't killed him. But looking back, it doesn't matter. What matters is how, for the first time in my life, I felt as if I existed for something. So, you know, although this child turns into a male prostitute, although his sexual life has been kind of deformed by this experience of abuse, he has some fond memories of Coach. Coach cared about him, he thinks. You know, I think a lot of people will be very uncomfortable hearing this degree of ambiguity in Neil's experience of being abused.
I mean, for people who've been abused, I mean, I've heard statistics as high as 1 in 4 children in America are experience some sort of sexual abuse. And that, I think, is what is so powerful about the story, is that it is ambivalent for a lot of people, and it does. And then there's the guilt associated with that. I mean, Joe Gordon-Levitt, who does such an amazing job playing 18-year-old Neil, is kind of a method actor, and he and I had a lot of talks about Neil's character, and because Neil does talk about the coach in this very sort of idealized way, almost kind of romantic way, talking about how he's the one true love of his life, and how, you know, when the summer that they were together was sort of, you know, this affair that he kind of can't forget. And, you know, my feelings had always been. I mean, Scott might feel differently, having being much closer to the characters than me. But as somebody, as when I read the book and my sort of take on the film as I was directing it, was really feeling like, in a way, Neil is more damaged even than Brian. I mean, Brian, the boy who believes he was abducted, is introverted, nervous, asexual, wets the bed, has these blackouts and nosebleeds. I mean, he's just sort of a nervous wreck, essentially, after this trauma. Whereas Neil, on the surface, is, this sort of beautiful James Dean, rebel without a cause, kind of sexual, the sexy sort of bad boy. But he's acting out in this incredibly sort of self-destructive way, this kind of hypersexual self-destructive way. And I think that his damage is so much it's so much deeper and so much more sort of internalized. I mean, Joe and I talked a lot about how Neil is sort of incapable of attachment and connection, and that one of the characters says about Neil that he has a black hole where his heart should be. And as always, my feeling that the Neil character, I feel like at the end of the movie, he sort of realizes that he. Brian has been living in this sort of fantasy world of believing he was abducted, and I think Neil, in his own way, has a kind of awakening in terms of he's sort of seeing his abuse for the first time without the sort of rose-colored glasses of his first crush.
As I mentioned in the novel, the first time that the boy Neil sees Coach, he's already attracted to men. And looking back, he remembers that the first time he saw Coach, he thought, desire sledgehammered my body. And in the movie, what you do, Greg, the first time Neil sees Coach, and Coach is running towards him because this is at the Little League field.
Running towards him in slow motion.
In slow motion, as if it's one of those corny romance movies where...
It's like Bo Derek in 10.
Exactly, exactly. And I thought, that's such a kind of clever way of getting at that inappropriately romantic feeling that the boy has. Can you talk about deciding to do it that way?
I wanted that moment obviously the coach is going to change Neil's life in a profound way, and so there was that sort of corny, cliched slow motion moment. But it's true, interesting when people have a moment like that where they meet somebody that's going to change their life. Frequently, they describe it in cheesy movie terms as like a slow motion moment, and so that was very kind of natural. The reverse shot of Chase was actually that shot was the idea of the cinematographer Steve Gaynor, the amazing Steve Gaynor.
It's one of those track zooms where there's a close-up of young Neil staring at the coach, and his background is sort of shifting, but the size of his face in the frame is staying the same because of the shifting perspective of the lens. So it's sort of this kind of compressing moment for young Neil. And then it's also sort of intercut with these flash frames of these kind of cheesy playgirl type centerfolds from the 70s. So, which is kind of a reference to a scene that's more developed in the book where young Neil discovers these playgirl magazines as a young boy under his mother's bed. And that was actually one of the scenes in the book that really, really kind of nailed me, in the sense that it's such a vivid memory for me that I think I was slightly older, maybe like 10 or 11, but I remember the first time I saw my first Playgirl centerfold, and it was that kind of a moment. It really sort of, it's like a revelation for me.
I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been great.
Greg Araki wrote, directed, and produced the new movie Mysterious Skin. It's based on the novel of the same name by Scott Heim.